Welcome to On Background, the podcast where we dive deep into the nuts and bolts of Canadian politics. I'm your host, Fred DeLorean. Today marks a special episode for us. For the first time, we're doubling the insight and doubling the expertise by having not one, but two distinguished guests joining us simultaneously. It's a bit like taking off my training wheels here, so let's see how this goes. First up, we have Tyler Meredith, a name many of you will recognize as a former economic advisor to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Tyler's resume is nothing short of impressive. He was the lead author of the Liberal Party of Canada's winning election platforms in both 2019 and 2021, played a pivotal role in the delivery of 6 federal budgets and 5 economic statements, and has been instrumental in drafting numerous ministerial mandate letters during times of government transition. Tyler's insights into the inner workings of Canada's economic policy are unparalleled, and we're thrilled to have him with us. And joining Tyler and I, and bringing a different perspective to our table, is my longtime friend and collaborator, Laura Kirkamaki. Laura and I have hit the campaign trail together numerous times, advocating for conservative values across this great country. Her experience is as vast as it is valuable, from serving as the national youth organizer for the Conservatives to running issues management for Prime Minister Stephen Harper, acting as principal secretary to Aaron O'Toole, and most recently serving as deputy campaign manager for the Conservative Party in the last general election. Laura's depth of experience in political strategy and campaign management is sure to offer a unique lens through which to view today's topics. And what better time to bring these two brilliant minds together than during budget season? It's that hectic period when lobbyists are on edge, bureaucrats, political staffers, and indeed the entire machinery of government is running at full tilt. Today, we aim to peel back the layers of this frenetic time, offering you insights from two individuals who've navigated these waters from opposing shores. So, grab your beverage of choice, settle in as we go on background, discussing, debating, and demystifying the complexities of Canadian politics from the viewpoints of those who've shaped it from both sides of the aisle. Welcome to the show, Tyler and Laura.
Thanks for having us.
Wow, thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So, stupid question to start us off. What is the budget number? What is the actual total that we spent, say, last year, or any budget that you've overseen? Because it's... Having been in Ottawa for decades, I've actually never heard, you know, we hear what the deficit is.
Yeah.
We hear what the number is, you know, how close we are, how far we are off from the you know, from being balanced. But how much do we spend a year?
So total government, depends what you want to define it as revenues or expenditures, which maybe gives away whether you believe it should be balanced in which direction. total expenditures would in a given year be somewhere between $450 billion to $500 billion, depending on if we're talking this year or in the outer years, and if we're in a pandemic or not. But yeah, like the federal budget is, you know, several hundred billions of dollars. And what's interesting about it is, to your point, Fred, we focus on the really minute number of how far off we are from zero on a deficit and how far off we are from where we thought it would be given the previous forecast.
Right. It seems like the only measure we keep, right?
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that, like, the actual things that change in a budget are relatively small in a given year in terms of new initiatives or things that are being that are affected by, say, economic growth. There's a whole base underneath it, right, that's just there, that continues to operate because it's the EI system, it's the old age security, it's guaranteed income supplement, it's the Canada Health Transfer, these things that are kind of automatic, right? They're big, big parts of the budget, but yet we don't really touch them, apart from a few times here or there when there's big policy changes. But a budget is often, even though it's this massive universe of $400 or $500 billion, the actual things that we're touching in a given year could be in the order of 20 to 50 billion.
So when Liberals first took government in 2015, was it same, like, $400 to $500 billion, same range?
No, it was smaller. So if some of my, you know, friends and other than Laura and the Conservative Party who used to do my kind of job, like Sean Spear, were here, he'd make note of the fact that it was more like $250 to $300 billion.
Right.
Okay, that sounds a bit better.
So that's, yeah. So that number has
so
changed quite a bit.
It's
gone up. I mean, we've been in office for 7 or odd years.
You did have a pandemic. I'll give you that. And I think a lot of the pandemic spending, I think the pandemic spending made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Having been, I was involved in politics then, running the other side, and you guys threw the money at the, you know, we yeah. all, Canadians needed to yeah. be helped during that period.
For sure. And but it's also true that the size of government has increased over time. Just to give a, you know, an example. So prior to Mr. Trudeau coming into office, I have the exact numbers maybe slightly off, but it gives you the order of magnitude. Program spending, the total kind of budget of the federal government as a share of GDP, or even, sorry, if we looked at total expenditures, as a share of GDP would be about 14.7% or so of GDP. Today, it's effectively at about 17 and change. And so there's been an increase. There's been an increase not only because of, as you said, things like the pandemic, and some of those expenditures have come up. Most of those expenditures have come off. There's some that are still there. But it's also because the size of government we've decided should be a bit larger, to do things like the Canada Child Benefit, to invest in infrastructure, to invest in housing, to invest in, to expand you know, things like the guaranteed income supplement. And that's on top of just natural changes like demography that are happening, which as we get older means we have more people who are going to claim those things like OAS and GIS, which are a big part of what the federal government spends.
So we're getting deeper than I thought right out of the gate, particularly with this question, because Canadians seem angrier now than they have been for a long time. But it's not, we're spending more, the federal government's spending more, giving them more, doing different things, yet people seem to be hurting more. How do we correlate that? How does this square?
Well, maybe this question isn't directed at me, but maybe it's because there's all of this spending and Canadians aren't feeling like they're getting any of it.
Right. So where's the money going?
Yeah.
I think there is certainly an aspect that if we were to, you know, stand on the street and do a streeter with people here in the Byward Market, I'm pretty sure that there'd be some people who would ask, you know, we're spending all this money, what are we getting it for? Because we've seen some things in the media recently where it looks like government can't kind of do anything, right? There's definitely a delivery issue, right? Like I think it's fair to say that on some programs there's a delivery issue. Although people forget that there's actually a lot of things that the government does, whether it's passports. Yes, that was a problem.
Was
a problem. But actually today, you know, more than 90% of people in the last year, they're going to get their passport on time. They're going to get, they're going to, no, it's actually a very efficient, it's actually a very efficient government service, right? You go through airport screening. For the most part in Canada, you go through an airport screening. It's actually going to be pretty efficient. So my point is, yes, it's true that there have been some things in the media recently that I think do undercut the general kind of trust that people may have in government to deliver big things. I actually think that the mood of the country, as dour as it is frankly just an overhang of a couple of things. One is we came out of the pandemic and we were all kind of angry because we all had to sit in our houses and be excluded from, you know, active life in a way that I think we didn't like, and some may have questioned whether it was worth it. But we also, you know, are feeling the pressure of higher interest rates and
right.
the feeling that mm-hmm. life is actually more expensive. And mm-hmm. yes, our wages have gone up, but if you go to the grocery store and the price of food looks like it is still much higher than you would ordinarily pay for, you know, bread or for milk or for you know, vegetables, that adds up over time, right? And if you're a family with a mortgage, few people have the ability to absorb, you know, a shock of several thousand dollars a year in extra mortgage expenses that they weren't previously planning for. So all of these things, even though we actually are earning more income, we are earning more income even on a real basis than we were before, it's just the combination of those pressures on the household budget, I think, make it pretty frustrating for people right now.
Yeah, you're right. I think, to be fair, I mean, like, inflation is a worldwide issue right now. It's not just in Canada. So we're seeing, you know, sure, the government has spent a lot more and created these programs. But at the same time, it's around the world right now that costs have gone up and interest rates and whatnot. Curious to talk about the process of building the budget. How is a budget built from the ground up? Obviously, different ministries, they submit their asks. And look, I should say I'm guessing at this. I worked in PMO, I've worked at the party, I've been around in politics. To me, budget time is like that fun day in the week where everyone gets together that night after it's delivered and we hang out and have drinks. Used to be at Highs when we were in government. I don't know what happens now.
We go to the Met.
Now the Met. Right, the Met is now the place.
Yes.
But from your side of it, how does this all function and how is this all built? And Laura, being a lobbyist that works with lots of clients too, I'd love to hear what you have on that.
So maybe I'll start in describing the timeline. And then I know because along that timeline, you know, Laura and some of the folks that she works with would be popping into to the process. But the process of the budget starts, if you assume that the budget is generally tabled in kind of late March, early April, I think only once in certainly the government that I've been part of has tabled it in February. So often it's in March or April. That process starts actually usually in November. And so it's, you know, effectively like a 4 to 5 month process. And it starts obviously with a request to ministers to send in their priorities and to have collated for the Minister of Finance all of the things that various ministers would be asking for. And then, you know, you take a grab bag of all of those requests across, let's say, 35 different ministers, and they may each have 10 things in the list of what they are asking for in a given year. Not all of those 10 things are super political things. Those could be anywhere from, like, we need to buy some more mainframe computers because the EI system is going to break because our punch card EI system that we've been using since the 1960s is about to fall apart, right? There's few votes in doing that, but if it screws up, right?
Well, there's a lot of votes
problems.
To be lost.
Exactly, right?
If you screw it
and
up.
So you've got to balance those different priorities as a minister of what you put forward of the sexy political things and the things that are the program, what we call program integrity, that you have to do because it's the basic function of government. Each minister is going to have potentially 10 things that they put in. You add that up, that's 350 different demands. That's before you've considered anything from the outside world, from stakeholders.
Yep.
Before you've considered anything that, you know, that a minister might have missed that, say, the Prime Minister's office thinks is super timely and important.
Right.
And before just other events happen. And so if you think about it as a decision-making process, it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of individual requests and decisions. And the first thing you have to do is to decide what is the stuff that I absolutely don't care to look at because I'm never gonna mm-hmm. do this. It's low priority. It has no politics behind it, or it's just not the time. And so you've got to go through what we call a triage process where you would say, I care about this. I don't care about that. Let's look at this. I haven't decided if we're going to do it. It's just to decide, should we even think about it, right? Because you don't have time in 4 or 5 mm-hmm. months to process 500 notes on something because you got to do analysis on every single one of these things.
Right.
So Tyler, quick yeah. question, intervention. Before you tell the ministers to send in their requests,
yeah.
you give them some parameters.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Like theme and topic. And
yes.
That. Okay.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because you would often say to the minister, like to cabinet, and usually this starts even earlier in, say, you know, September or late summer when they've done the when they do the cabinet retreat, as they think about just what are their priorities for the next season, the minister of finance will give a kind of forecast about what do they see where the economy's headed, where they would ideally like to take the fiscal framework, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that is meant to orient ministers as they think about the kinds of things that they want to put forward. And you know, oftentimes there will be an exercise in that process to say, now you really should know we don't have a lot of money to spend. So you should not come to me expecting that you're going to get a lot of money. But that still doesn't stop ministers, right, from putting
right.
stuff
yeah.
on the page, in part because they have a duty to their own mandate letter to the Prime Minister and the things that the Prime Minister is expecting them to deliver on that they have to show that they, as a good minister, have worked on. But also, to be honest, like a minister also has to kind of negotiate with their department because the mm-hmm. department has a whole bunch of priorities and things that they would like to see. And you as a minister have to decide, how do you navigate that, mm-hmm. right? Like how do you, because taking on things that the department wants to do, you may be expending your own political capital. So that process occupies a lot of time in the kind of the late fall until you kind of by Christmas have come to an agreement on what the universe is of things that you're going to look at. And that's a decision between PMO, between finance, about the things that they are going to want to look at. Because it's really those two organizations, right? They're the two deciders in the process. And then once you have agreement on that, and this is kind of around the time I think folks like Laura would be out there talking to, you know, to clients and to stakeholders about what's of interest, you start to get the drumbeat of requests that come in. And so that initial universe may grow over time as you begin to hear and see other things that you want to take in. But you're trying to manage it more or less to about 300 items because, again, you got to generate paper. And this city loves to run on paper, but there's only so much paper that it can generate. Yeah. And then you just you start to do the analysis. And the prime minister and the finance minister will decide on what the overall kind of envelope is that they want to work with. That will be informed by a survey of economists that they've done. And once you have those kind of parameters in place, you just start to work through the notes and you make decisions. And then you go back and revise. And that takes 2 to 3 months.
It's interesting hearing that because my perspective, I think, you know, the budget process almost starts as quickly as the one before ends, which is that stakeholders for a large part of the summer are actually working usually on their House of Commons Finance Committee pre-budget submission. So I find it very entertaining that you're like not even thinking about that.
It's you know, it's funny. I sometimes say to people, I'm like, you should put the paper in.
Yeah,
you should submit. Because it's good to at least do the exercise of getting yourself to think about it. Nobody's reading it. Nobody's reading
it. Don't say that out loud, Tyler.
Killed half the industry.
I'm sorry. I apologize. But think of it realistically. People aren't in August sitting around waiting for the paper to come in. You should do the work because there's a process that's been established. Mm-hmm. And there's no question that standing committees, parliamentary standing committees like FINA, Finance Committee, are an important element of that process, and it's good to use the submissions, you know, to engage with those folks. But at the Department of Finance, nobody's sitting there reading that stuff in August. They will get to it eventually in January, right? And I've always found if you go on, parl.gc.ca, or I guess our commons, whatever it now is, .ca/FINA, and you look at the standing committee's website, and they always have this great inventory of all the submissions they've ever received, right? You can do a deep dive. Like you can just go through those 900 submissions and be like, what's interesting in here? I'll just pull this out, right, and read it. So people do that for sure. But I often think it's really, in some ways, unfair to stakeholders because we're asking them to start to get ready to engage in a process that is months and months and
months
before.
Yeah, that you're not actually ready to engage in. To be honest, I think it's useful in that, yes, it makes people think about what they might want, but then also the fall is normally spent engaging, so then they already have a piece of paper. It would be nice if you could tell some people to make the deadline September after the long weekend because people are on vacation and you know.
So Peter Fonseca, sort of if you're listening to this podcast, we suggest that you should change.
Yeah, after Labor Day weekend.
I agree. I think it would be much fairer to people. And it's true because, you know, to your point, like, the fall economic statement hasn't even happened by that point
exactly.
in time, let alone getting to plan for the budget.
Yeah. So sometimes people are putting things, organizations, I should say, are putting things in their submission that actually gets addressed in the fall economic statement, or then by the time that happens is already addressed or isn't as timely. It's too far away. I mean, that's 9 months basically between. But then, of course, there is the Department of Finance consultation process. So maybe you should chat a bit about if you find that one a little bit more useful, or you have in the past.
So, you know, there's variations, obviously, of how those department-run consultations have been structured. Sometimes they're accompanied by roundtables that the minister will do where, you know, she knows in advance what the themes are that she wants to talk about in the budget. And so she will orchestrate a series of events in part to actually get real intelligence and get real expert input that's useful to the decision process. But it's also to kind of telegraph publicly, this is important to me. People should know that this is something we're kind of thinking about, right? And so you can almost see in the course of the last month, Minister Freeland has been around doing a bunch of these roundtables about housing, about research and innovation, about decarbonization, about getting pension funds to invest, all of which are likely going to be things that she will want to talk about in the budget. And so that process is important from a signaling perspective in telling you what they think is important. I would say that the challenge, of course, is that often, and I'm sure, Laura, you see this, is like people will take their ask that they've written for FINA and then they'll just put that into this other process. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But in a way, the thing that actually matters is going in and trying to talk to somebody.
For sure.
Because it's very hard as a staffer, right? Again, imagine that this is about a 4.5 to 5 month process. You are a staff of a team of maybe, you know, at finance, maybe 6 policy advisors, and in PMO, maybe 5 or 6 policy advisors. So, you know, of a universe of 300 notes, right, you can just do the math. You're maybe going to have to advise on 50 notes potentially or more.
That's a lot.
like, you got to write your own analysis, and you got to go and talk to stakeholders about, that are relevant to all those things. It's very hard to pay attention to everything that's moving in that short period of time.
Yeah. No, that's fair.
So how many meetings do you think you've taken this process leading up to this? How many meetings do you think you have individually with stakeholders?
Like the fall and then also up until the end of February.
You know what's funny? So iPolitics, of course, does this very well. They often will produce the list of which staffers have taken the most meetings, right? And it's, you will find often there usually is someone from finance on the list as being a top staffer in meeting with people. In some ways, that's good because, finance should be more open, and I think at times has been criticized for being hard to get access to. But it's frankly because to do your job to advise on those notes, you have to go out and talk to people. I mean, I've always said to staff, don't just take the there's some meetings you need to take because you need to hold the relationship and they need to know that they could have a meeting with finance. That's important. But you should take certain meetings intentionally because you're there to try to pull in information that's going to make your note better, that you're going to give to the minister that now has intelligence and insight that the department can't do. Because to be honest, the department, they do meetings, but not as frequently as the political side does, in my experience.
Right.
And, you asked for a number. I couldn't imagine what a number would be. I would say if you're not meeting with at least one or two people a day, you're probably not doing your job well.
Tyler, you see a lot of stuff coming in your end. You're getting all this, being lobbied, being pursued by all of these stakeholders. Laura, on your side of it, where you're the lobbyist representing all these clients, what is it like on your side of it? And do you feel it's where your time is spent with the ministries or with the Department of Finance?
With whatever sector they're coming from with their ministries. I would say both. I think, normally throughout the year on other issues, say you're, coming from a non-financial industry, you're, a clean tech company or transportation or something like that. You're not necessarily dealing with finance outside of the budget time. So you would still be, it would be smart if you were, but you're focused on other issues that you might have working directly with officials that are regulating your industry or other things. So I think during budget time, they kind of shift and also add in prioritizing finance as well. And I would say PMO too, to a large part. We like to go to PMO and complain that we're not hearing back from ministers. We like to tattle when we've spent months and
it's just
ridiculous.
Do you find that sometimes? Do they?
It does work. Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, and that's part of the. Tyler won't like to hear that, but it's maybe unhelpful to the minister's offices. But you know what? For the most part,
if you're an important stakeholder.
Exactly. And so in large part, I have found them to be, they're obviously very busy and doing a lot of things at once. And, I had to manage that too when I was working there. But they are good kind of traffic cops in that way. So, if you do have especially an urgent matter that is legitimately urgent and it's not just...
So can I ask you though, so in the case of a sponsoring minister, right, who again in that description that we talked through about the budget where they're just as much of the minister is just as much of an input to the process as a stakeholder, right?
Yeah.
When stakeholders go to those originating departments before they go to finance or PMO, how do they actually have a conversation with that minister's office that doesn't just lead to, go talk to finance, right? Like how do you get them to engage in a substantive way? Because I can see that they have an easy excuse, potentially.
Oh, that is what they say every single time. Yeah, that is what they say. But they also have more background on the issues, I think. So, if a political staffer or a department, doesn't necessarily 100% need to make a decision, they will punt it to someone else. I mean, I was literally just watching, this speaks to what I do in my spare time, but watching a committee yesterday where the chair was arguing about whether or not program funding came actually, from this, it was Heritage Committee from this, or was it really at ISED? And if it was at ISED, then this committee shouldn't even be talking about it. So it's kind of indicative of what, you know, other ministries are like. But yeah. I think it's different if it's a budget ask that is actually favorable to the government, that's something that the government might be supportive of. In that case, then I think the ministries get a little bit more involved because the minister also wants to champion those things, right?
Well, and to your point, like, I think this speaks to a really interesting dynamic that happens in budget processes, which is, you know, the finance minister has to make a decision more or less on the basis of how they're managing the thing that they care about, which is the fiscal track. Mm-hmm. They also kind of want to still maintain good relations with their colleagues. But at the end of the day, their job is kind of to say no, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the prime minister's job as the leader of the government, as the leader of the party, as the leader of the cabinet, as the person who works with the deputy prime minister and the finance minister in all of those different capacities to have a broader view. And so, like, it's interesting sometimes to kind of watch how different internal coalitions can be created mm-hmm. within cabinet around issues where it's like, we actually have to run an inside campaign, right?
Well, that's issues. Exactly it. Like, and that's not as common, yeah. but definitely happens on, I would say, like, hotter issues, of yeah. course, maybe not about the budget. But yeah, you're right. Like, a lot of this is internal. And say you're at a ministry lobbying them and really, you know, for example, ISED, I guess, is a good example because, you know, there's so many different priorities and programs under it. It's like, okay, there's only so many things that they can champion. And mm-hmm. what is the minister going to go out on a limb on, right? He's asking finance. Okay, this is also probably a too sensitive equation, but like they're asking finance for so much, right? And that's the thing. Every minister can only ask the ministers that they have to work with for so many different things. And so they have to prioritize amongst themselves. So maybe what might happen in that case, you know, in the ISED case, it's like, okay, what's another minister that's or ministry that's maybe smaller, that doesn't have as many priorities that could become a champion for
well,
what they
and,
want?
Well, and right. just to prove that point, so without giving anything away, I will say in 2016, there was a minister who asked for a lot of things, and that really perturbed Bill Morneau at the time because they were not things that he felt was important to deliver and was actually, when they did a debrief, was pretty clear with this minister that, like, the reason you didn't get anything in this budget was because you asked for too many things and you
right.
weren't, you
didn't
did,
prioritize.
You clearly didn't prioritize, mm-hmm. right? It was obvious that you've put that problem on my desk to do
right.
it.
Yeah.
And so to that minister's credit, they went back and the next year they actually had a much more streamlined letter, and it was like only one or two things, and they got those things because there had been this like collaboration between the finance minister and the minister, mm-hmm. that other minister, to kind of like understand each other. And so much of this process is human, right? It is human interaction. Yeah. And, you know, how do you keep good relations with people? You know, how do I manage, you know, the different priorities that I have? And I don't want to say no to them on this thing, but I have to, but I eventually need to preserve some capital for that thing, right? It's humans working together.
Yeah. And in large part too, I mean, it's not just the ministers. I mean, obviously only so many things can go to their yeah. desk. There's yeah. also ways of working at the officials level, especially if it's more of a basic request, you know, like an existing program that had 3-year funding is up and these yeah. types of things. Like, I have some clients that are working on that where it's like, oh, our organization actually won't be able to function if this program yeah. doesn't get topped up or X, Y, and Z. In which case, department officials are usually very, if it's something that they know, of course, that the government is broadly supportive of, it's you don't necessarily have to ring alarm bells at, you know, all these different levels of the political staff in order to get positive recommendations.
So, okay, budget comes in, it's put together, it's packaged. To me, the budget is, from the comms side of politics, is obviously an immense communications tool, and it provides our products and all we're talking about for the next 6 months, and if it's a really good budget, a couple of years in terms of the themes that come out of it. I remember in 2009, we had, you know, our theme for that was building Canada's economic action plan to get us out of the Great Recession. And we ran on that for years, and it was a very tight narrative. Laura, I'm curious your thoughts on this, on how to sell the budget and what we're seeing in front of us. Like, I think the last number of years, I haven't, you know, No offense, Tyler. I don't remember what last year's theme was or the year before.
Well, he wasn't there.
Jobs and growth.
He's not taking offense.
Okay.
He's not taking offense.
Yeah.
Or a made in Canada plan for, you know.
But it just feels, it feels generic. Yeah. It feels like it's lost. I find the last number of budgets have just been kind of lost. The fall economic statement, same thing where they come out. It should be a major narrative driver. And I don't think the Liberals have done a good job in the last.
Well, not in fairness, I guess. Like, there's also been, you know, tons of other issues that have happened at the same time as the budget. I think last year we were in the foreign interference stuff was breaking right at the same time, and literally
but
like
your budget
a
should be
story.
So powerful if we're spending $400 to $500 billion to tie some kind of story together, you know, to like push through on this.
So you're both right. Like I think that the challenge with a budget, especially in modern times, and I'm not a communications expert, I'm a policy person, but my observation would be that there's just too much stuff, right, in a budget. And that's probably as true for conservatives as it is for liberals, even if like, you know, the size of the budget text probably was shorter in for conservative budgets because they were just they didn't do as much, right? Let alone just the words that you put around all this stuff. Which gets me to the point that I think we need to move away from thinking about the budget as one event, and more a process. And so there's a function that the budget serves, which is to update us all on what is the state of the economy and what's the kind of, to use a term that Minister Freeland loves to use, fiscal guardrails, of kind of what is the operating space that we're working within, right?
Why don't you like that term?
Well, no, I say because I'm sure you would laugh because I get that reaction. Yeah, you may not like that term. I'm just saying, the purpose of a budget in one part is to update us on what's going on, right? And what is the forecast of how we see things will change and what effects does that have on our overall fiscal plan? That's before we talk about any new things that we're going to announce.
So what do you mean? So you do the budget and then you announce the programs throughout?
Like, correct.
Or afterwards.
Correct.
Right. Yeah.
Or before. Like you basically decide at one point in time, here's all the things that I'm going to do that I'm going to plan for in budget. And then I'm going to start to announce those things as we go. And they're kind of now doing that anyway, right? With the weekly news conference.
Like they kind of just did that on Friday. Yeah. And it seems like they might start doing that, I guess, in March. I mean, you might know more about it than me. But it seems like that's kind of starting to
become more common. Because think about it, right? To my point, if you're assessing 300 or so items, and let's say you don't do the vast majority of those, but you still do 75, 100, 150 items, how do you communicate all of those things? Not all of those things are going to be things that you want to have a news conference about, but how do you communicate all those things in one document?
That's the problem where it's not tied together, though, right? Like where you need to say the same thing every week. You see Poilievre. Like I know Poilievre's message backwards and forward. Everyone does. I don't know Trudeau's because Poilievre is consistent and disciplined on it, and he's just punching through. So I feel like if you have your budget, you have 300 items, they're talking about these as all individual things that aren't tied together. And I think that's where the comms is failing on the Liberal side.
Well, there's also just no narrative. Like, that's the problem. Exactly. Like, what, last budget, they still were not even recognizing that housing was a big deal. Like, that wasn't until this summer that they finally, you know, at the retreat that Tyler was mentioning, that they were like, oh, you know, we're in a shitty position here. So I think last year it was just there was so much noise going on. It got completely drowned out. Wasn't more than one day. But you're right. Like with all of the spending that's been going on, why is this not? Why are there not more good things, I guess, for the Liberals to talk about, which actually has been coming up, I think, a lot more recently?
Yeah.
Like, can they change the channel essentially with
the
budget?
And I do think they are starting to get some more retail things. Like, just if you look at the fall economic statement, for example, as a case study, it's chock full with a lot of, you know, kind of some very micro targeted things. I would maybe argue that they're even too micro targeted because I'm not sure, you know, for example, like let's say on overdraft fees, right? If you walk into your bank and suddenly you realize that you bounced a check but you're not being charged for it anymore, do you know that that's because of Chrystia Freeland? Like, are you going to know that that's because of Justin Trudeau?
Right, wouldn't have a clue.
Exactly. But so you got to tell people that, right? You got to advertise that. And I think the challenge is they're actually starting to do some stuff that can click at a really retail level with people, but they have to put the communications muscle behind it with, I would argue, with some advertising, frankly, to be able to get out there and tell people that. And we haven't yet seen that next move. I think we might. I'm just saying, I think it needs its own separate plan of how you communicate that consistently, as opposed to, you know, we launch a budget, we've announced it, we do 1 week of tour, and we're done. Like, that's right. That plan, that structure doesn't work, I think, in the current environment.
Right. No, you need to. That's what's so interesting with the change of communications and, you know, media for the most part, regional local media is dying. It's direct communication now. Like, the biggest news outlet in Canada, I believe, is Pierre Poilievre. He's the one who gets the most information out there through his social media channels. And when we, you know, he's pushing his message, and all these other, you know, these micro announcements, I think just, it doesn't resonate when he is punching through on this with his message.
But that's the question. Like, why are they not advertising?
The government has an annual advertising budget. It's, I want to say, it's under $50 million overall. I don't remember the exact number, but it's, like, by memory, I think it's about somewhere between $25 and $50 million a year. But that occupies a lot of kind of standard, like, public service announcement kind of stuff, right? Like, you know, if you have a public health concern, call this number. If, you know, CPP benefits, call this number, like, which we need to do. But this government has been a bit reticent to put significant dollars behind advertising because they have often been worried about the criticism that, you know, you've read, you mentioned the Economic Action Plan. Some people during that period of time, you know, criticized the Harper government for being, and some people in the current Liberal caucus criticized the Harper government for being too overt in politicizing government action. Yeah. And I think,
how dare politicians play politics?
I agree with you. It's like there's gambling in this establishment, right? Like, we are sometimes too much of a Boy Scout, and I think we need to avoid that impulse.
I do not think that's been your problem.
I think it is. No, I actually agree with Tyler.
I know what
on
you're
this.
Saying. I think you're oversensitive about it.
They're
oversensitive to criticism. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not saying there's credit to be taken, but they're not, if they're taking credit for different projects, they should be. Like, the carbon tax is a great example where the communications, I think, has been terrible on this, where, again, not getting into the policy of it, but if there's rebates going to Canadians, Canadians have no idea or really are not aware that there's any rebates showing up in their bank accounts.
And it's also actually a really good example in some of these case studies about the role sometimes of political staff in being able to push, right? Because, as I think we will all not be surprised, you know, oftentimes if you were to go into the public service, regardless of who's in government, and say, we have this benefit that we've created, we want to advertise it, we'd like, you know, it to be really front of mind for people, we'd like to send people checks, right? Or we'd like to somehow make it more visible in the bank account that this transfer has happened. The public service will put up in front of you all manner of reasons why this cannot be done, why it's either inappropriate, or there are technical reasons why it can't be done, or, you know, the payment, for example, in the case of the carbon rebate, like, the payment message that banks use that is transmitted from the Government of Canada when the transfer happens differs across every institution because of our payment systems. And so, like, well, you know, to fix that, we're going to have to, you know, reinvent our payment rails. Like, no. This is not actually that complicated. Like, there is a way to fix this, but it requires oftentimes people to push back at the, you know, to not accept certain answers of no. And I'm not saying that you know, the government that I was part of, that people don't do that. People do that. I, you know, was part of a government that did that. But it is very hard, right, when you are faced with those various reasons by the public service to tell you why you cannot do something. You know, it's kind of, there's almost like a shaming that goes on, right? It's like, how dare you ask us these questions? Because, you know, it's challenging.
It fascinates me where, having worked in a lot of provincial jurisdictions as well, they don't seem to have that problem. And maybe I'm wrong, but in the ones that I've worked in, you know, the political class can push these things through, but federally in Ottawa, it seems to be so many more barriers in doing this, which I find interesting because it's the same political system, same people in many regards.
Yeah. I wonder if, like, you would attribute it to just a lot of staff turnover recently, because I will say when we were at PMO, we didn't have too many issues pushing back on that kind of thing.
That was our attitude too, right? When conservatives, when we were in government, there was this very clear us versus them.
Yeah.
With the bureaucracy. In fact, with you guys, it feels like it's, you know, mommy,
in fact,
mommy and daddy are home. The liberals are back.
Exactly. In fact, when we're told we can't do something, we dig in further and want to know.
Sign a decision note. Yeah, it's done.
But I wonder if they're just, you know, towards the end of a mandate, you know, if there's just been so much turnover that maybe the staff aren't as confident.
I think you're right that the turnover of staff, and there has been a lot in the last couple of years, is a contributing factor to some of that. You know, a great example, right? Like with the Canada Child Benefit, we came into power and, you know, within weeks of taking power, we had, you know, CRA telling us, you must make all of these final decisions ASAP or we will not be able to deliver checks by July. And we're like, well, hold on. Like, we've got to, there's a bunch of things that have to go on here. We won't be able to make these decisions until the budget. Like, calm down. We will still be able to meet a July timeline. And we did. We did. And that, and my point is, there is this kind of built-in risk aversion in the public service. And part of it may be because of size. Like, this is a, you know, public service is very large and it's very easy to overcomplicate things because of that. But part of it is also, I think we are, compared to certainly smaller provinces, a lot more careful about or concerned about that kind of political intervention concern. Certainly in governments that I've been
part of. You're 100% right. There's a real fear of political intervention in the federal government, where provincially I don't see that. It seems like it's expected. Like deputy ministers and different appointments, provincial governments just tend to make. But here, if you put in a partisan person as a deputy minister, that would be a massive scandal.
Yeah. And we should have people that move back and forth. Like, we should.
I agree.
Like, yeah.
You should have, as Premier Ford would say, you should have like-minded people in positions that are relevant, that are important.
You know, it's funny. So I saw that story, right?
So we're talking judges' appointments here.
Yeah, sorry.
Complete topic.
Hey, we're sitting around having drinks. We can talk about whatever we want to talk about.
I saw that story, and I thought to myself, you know, I completely understand the notion of wanting to diversify the sources of input that advises on appointments processes. Like, you can see in different governments, whether it's judicial appointments or whatever, like, that's a thing, right? Like,
yeah. Well, if Dominic LeBlanc puts in five of his neighbors as judges just recently, right? I see your point. Go on.
Or five Irvins.
But how do you do that in a way that doesn't raise the other legitimate concern about politicization, right? Because I think you could, and I don't know those two individuals personally, but I don't believe either of them are lawyers. And that would, if I were to make a comment, it would be to say, well, you know, we do need diverse experience, but how do we balance that with the right skill set around the table that can give us advice on what, you know, judges? Anyway, I know that's not what we were meant to talk about, but I think you've got a fair point there that, you know, there is this. In Ottawa especially, there is this risk about political interference that I think sometimes we take to extremes.
Yeah.
I have a budget question to bring us back. Okay, so for folks that are maybe listening to this podcast in real time, in the time period that we're in right now, where in theory, maybe you know more, in theory, PMO should either have received the budget by now from finance or should be getting it at some point in short order.
They've been getting it all throughout.
Okay, that was my question. Are they waiting for a final document or have they seen bits and pieces?
So there's two different pieces to the budget, right? There's the decisions, the individual decision notes that's like, you know, just a piece of advice that goes to the minister or the prime minister on any given issue, which is an individual, like, we're going to give $10 million to public safety for this purpose next year, and do we agree? There's the decisions, and then there's the actual book, right? The actual text.
Right.
And those two things are kind of being done at the same time. And so you're building the book as decisions are still being made. And so there are versions of the book that will circulate for communications purposes for review that have to be looked at both for accuracy, but also for, like, telling the right story. And that comes in at different times. And that comes later because obviously you need decisions. But PMO, because the Prime Minister, you know, is the second key in this two-key system, they've been getting binders of decisions from the Minister of Finance's office, you know, as in real time as it happens.
Okay.
Yeah. And think about it again. It's like 10 binders And, you know, you finish one binder, you make a series of decisions, done, onto the next binder. And as that binder's done, it gets moved on to PCO and PMO, and then they make their decisions, so on.
And I'm curious how the Liberals do this, where, you know, I always assumed it's you go in with an idea. It's like I have this program I want funded. It costs $10 million. You look at it and say, I'm not so sure, but I can give you $50 million. Is that typically how it works with the Liberals? Or no. Sorry.
Or if it's titled green budget ass.
Yes, if it's a green ass, is it $100 million?
I will just say budgets are art, not science. You know, people spend a lot of time in the budget process thinking about how do I ensure that the shape of the fiscal track, which is like what's the size of the deficit this year, next year, the year after, what's the, you know, deficit to GDP, debt to GDP numbers, how do those numbers track over time? How do they change? How off are they from the forecast? Are they continuing to kind of go down in a consistent fashion, or is there a blip up? You spend a lot of time focusing on those shapes. And you make shaves to those shapes, right, over time. And it means sometimes you go back and the $10 million thing that was decided 2 weeks ago suddenly becomes zero because we just need to take out a whole bunch of expenses in one particular year because we have a problem in one particular year of a five-year track. That's the kind of decision-making that happens.
Right.
And so, you know, yes, you can be convinced on one particular issue, the very narrow issue that we can all agree on is important to do. But it is one issue amongst 100 or more other things that might appear in the budget, and they have to all compete with each other to sit in the right place in dollar numbers in the right year, and so like nothing is finalized until it's all done.
So what do you think the budget's looking like for 2024? Do you think first of all, do you think it's coming in March on the 1 week that those are sitting?
It's 1 week. It's gotta be April.
And then what, like obviously we're hearing it could be in April.
It could be, it's either the third week of March or the second week of April, I think.
Right.
And just on the sitting calendar and like where I think they're trying to achieve. It's not the worst thing in the world if it's the second week of April, but I think there is something to be said about trying to be before March 31st because it's a nice way to say, you know, we are managing things well.
Nice. They want to start now. That's
good. No. Well, no, but I mean, like it's a nice, it conveys a sense of, a sense of control. Right. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of pressures building in the system to kind of make sure that they can land the plane somewhere in March if they could, because I say it's not the worst thing if it's the second week of April. There's no real big difference, but you're right. The sitting calendar dictates it's either kind of those two dates. Mm-hmm. I think fiscally, what we're set up for is the economy's better than it was looking even probably in the fall economic statement. We're going to see probably some upward revision to GDP, both in terms of what people are forecasting in the future, but also what the base is. That will have the effect of giving the minister a little bit more space because, her anchor is ultimately the size of the deficit as a share of GDP. But she has set a line in the sand, right? She has put a marker down in the fall economic statement, particularly about wanting to be at about 1% of GDP on the deficit in 2025-26. And that, she's right now, if you follow the track from the fall economic statement, she's a little bit off that. And so it means she's got to find ways either to have a stronger economy that gives her fiscal benefits or be shorter on spending or have some revenue. And it's a combination of those three things that makes a budget.
What I find interesting is Poilievre's public statements on this. You know, his new plan for the next election, he's got his 4 points. One of them being fix the budget. It's no longer balance the budget. Yeah. It's no longer, you know, that which has always been a mainstay of the Reform Party and the Conservative Party was to bring budget to balance. And I think it could be because things are just so out of whack and he doesn't know what it's going to get to when he eventually takes power, if he takes power. I find it fascinating to fix the budget. Yeah. Like that to me is a very strong statement as a conservative to say we are actually probably not going to balance it anytime soon.
You're right, because I don't know what he means by fix the budget. I think what he means, based on just the premise that he's set up in the past about why he thinks the budget is problematic, is that he believes and would like you to think that the budget is inflationary, right? And that the reason that your cost of living is expensive today is because Trudeau ran up the debt, mm-hmm. and because government is overspending. And
he truly believes that. I think that's truly his view of this.
Sure. It's not true. It's categorically not true. Like all government. So as I'm an economist, right?
I'm just saying,
for the budget to be inflationary, we have to not just think about the federal budgets, like total government spending in Canada. Total government spending in Canada last year, so in the previous fiscal year, had ran a cumulative deficit at the provincial, municipal, and federal level of about 0.7% of GDP. So in other words, you could take the four and change inflation rate that we had last year, and it could be smaller by about 70 basis points potentially. So we'd still have, instead of a 4.5% or 4.3% inflation rate last year, we'd still have an inflation rate somewhere in the mid threes, right? So it's not even, it doesn't even explain half of the excess inflation that we have experienced, right?
Right.
And to be fair, even if you decompose all of that spending, in the federal government's case, $2 out of the $3 in last year's deficit was a bunch of accounting money that was set aside for litigation expenses that aren't going to be paid for years. They're not actual cash into the economy, which is what inflation would ultimately be. So just speaking on the facts, he's wrong. But what
hurts politically to the liberal side, though, is that he was saying this during the pandemic, that your increased spending is going to lead to this. You do the increased spending, and now we have massive inflation.
Yeah, it's the prediction.
So he was right in predicting that inflation was coming.
Yep. So I give him full credit for having been more vocal about that compared to, frankly, even most economists on Bay Street.
And not just vocal. He was doing a great job putting out his videos right before the last election that he made.
So, Fred, I can tell. So in as recently as April of 2022, right? So right after the Bank of Canada is already starting to raise interest rates and we're, conceivably like later than they should have, I'm meeting with chief economists on Bay Street who are telling me, we think interest rates, they're going to rise, but they're going to top out somewhere around 2.5.
Wow.
We ended up at 5, right?
Wow.
So, like, that's how much collectively all of the
so
smart people in Canada.
So much mistrust with all these guys, though, right? Like again, Pierre called. Like, he said it was going to go through the roof, and it did.
Sure. Well, I mean, I give him credit that he correctly called a trend that a lot of other smart people, the broad consensus of people did not. So he gets credit for that, and he's getting political credit for that right now. But what's interesting, though, about the, like, what does fix mean to your question? What does fix the budget mean? It's been fascinating to me to watch the evolution that conservatives have gone through, and this is where I'd love Laura's perspective on fiscal policy, because in 2015, Stephen Harper, as you said, was like, balance the budget, zero at any cost. In 2019, Andrew Scheer was balance the budget in 5 years. In 2021, it was balance the budget in 10 years. Now it's fix the budget. So I'm assuming fix the budget is maybe somewhere between 5 and 10. But I don't know. He hasn't specified a number. But like that evolution within conservatives from 0 to 5 to 10 years as what is an acceptable period of time over which to balance the budget. Like, it's been fascinating to watch those goalposts change.
Well, because you've been spending so much. It's hard. Yeah. You're instituting so many programs. It's hard to...
But I'm just curious, like, how did you guys talk about this internally about, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but like, is 10 years is totally manageable. In fact, the budget would balance itself. but seriously, you could put government finances on autopilot over the next number of years. And before we get to, you don't want to spend new money, but I'm saying if we stop doing new things.
Right.
We could balance on its own. The government books would balance themselves within less than 10 years, probably 5. And so, like, when when we saw the commitment of 10 years by the conservative, like, that's not radical. That's actually not, that's very achievable and gives you space to actually do new things. So I'm curious, like, that just the discussions have happened in conservatives that have made them comfortable with that.
Yeah, I think it's very leader-driven. I think it's probably the case. And then the policy team that's around them, right? And what matches with their vision? What do they want to do on other areas that would lead to, in Aaron's case, I would say, maybe meeting the 2% defense spending NATO target would be something that, would cost a lot of money. So maybe there's different commitments that different leaders have that causes them, or maybe in other cases like we're seeing now, like with cuts in spending, like maybe if you're willing to go down that road, then you're able to balance the budget sooner. So I think it just depends, like, of course, what economic time you're in, what your overall goals are, and then what people are comfortable with, essentially.
And I think going into an election, looking at these, you're talking about our campaign platforms, right? So it's about the Liberals are very good at fear-mongering of what the Conservatives will do if they ever get in power, right? Like, that's your playbook. Like, that's not...
A cut.
What will we cut?
Everything
right?
is a cut.
So it's always, like, you got to look at the fiscal framework and where we are and where Canadians are in their mindset. But that's the biggest thing is what, you know, you get hammer on us what we're going to cut, all the different services. Mm-hmm. And I know that's something that's always every Conservative leader is cognizant of. When I was really getting into politics in the, you know, early 90s as a kid, as one of those nerds, balanced budgets was such a big thing. It was the Reform Party that was pushing it. So maybe the Liberals were looking at it as this was their main opponent. So how do you take that sword away from your main opponent? Because the Reform Party was very, very disciplined on pushing for balanced budget because at their core, they believed in that. But we've gotten away from that where, you know, I would say the Conservative Party of Canada is not as ideological or as, you know, clear as the Reform Party with their goals. It's about, we're now an election winning machine. The Conservative Party is. We want to take government now. So we have to play that game. And it's not always.
And I also think it's generational, right? Like, even amongst Liberals, if you were to come across staff of that era, the same era that you described, I think they generally would put more emphasis on, you know, we would like to see governments have a goal of setting to have a balanced budget by a certain date and making more effort, if not progress, effort at least on that. Or be seen to demonstrate effort. And younger staff and younger voters who have grown up in a different economic time, especially post 2008, I think have realized that. You know, what does that actually do for me, right? What does a balanced budget do for me?
Yeah, exactly.
No, it doesn't resonate with people anymore. Yeah, I don't think no one notice what that means.
Yeah. And Trudeau, I would say, too, kind of proved that, right? By, you know, in 2015, you know, he said he would run deficits. And I remember...
he delivered on that promise.
You know, yeah, in a big way. and I... You know, there's always a clip of Harper saying, like, he's just going to run a little deficit. And, like, everyone thought, like, that was so crazy at the time. Remember that he was, you know, and Fred was plugging along the doors at that point.
I was a candidate. No one cared.
No one cared, yeah. And so, yeah, maybe who knows what this kind of, like, fix the budget means. But, you know, it's – I think things have evolved.
Yeah, and look, like – I also would make the case, and this is, you know, stepping back a little bit to the policy space. So you kind of needed the federal government to run deficits a bit in the mid to late 2010s because provinces were in a much were not as strong fiscally as they are today. And they did not have the capacity to invest in things like healthcare and education and infrastructure and housing. And so you kind of needed the federal government, who had a much safer balance sheet because, you know, Stephen Harper had actually in some ways done a good job of containing risks to future transfer programs that enabled the federal government to almost be in a place of having a long-term structural surplus. The PBO had estimated in 2014 that, you know, long-term, the federal government would have somewhere in the order of about 1.4% of GDP of spending room that it could take on without worrying about its debt-to-GDP ratio rising over time because it had a very stable position. And it would make sense that if the provinces can't spend, the federal government can, you kind of want to have those two things working in together. We're now in a different space, right? We're now in a space where provinces are actually in much better fiscal shape, in part because of things like COVID, but also because of some economic changes that have been happening in our country. And the federal government now has some tighter fiscal space. And it's very interesting to watch the transition of those two things, where, you know, the provincial governments like Doug Ford have space to spend. And, you know, the federal government has to actually, you know, do things like program review.
There's so many parts of the budget that I'm not aware of, and I think a lot of Canadians aren't aware of that. I think we just talked about a lot today, so I think this was fantastic, and I really thank the two of you for coming on to chat about this. So, Tyler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Laura, it's been great.
I think all of us here are looking forward to seeing everyone at the Met on budget night whenever we have the budget date.
Sounds good. We'll see you there.
We'll see you there.
All right, folks, thanks so much for listening in. This was a really fun podcast talking about budget with two amazing people from opposite sides of the aisle. We had Tyler Meredith from Meredith Bosenkuhl Policy Advisors and Laura Kirkamaki from Earnscliff Strategies. Please like and subscribe and send this around to your friends, and we will see you next week on another episode of On Background.